Hello.
Yes.
All right, I think we're on the line.
Okay.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, how are you, Clemente?
I'm doing awesome, man. How are you?
Good, good. I hear there's big things going on over there, huh?
Yeah, there's some changes. And I'm sure you're keeping pretty busy over there.
Yeah. Is so Kalo's in town looking at the shop around schools?
Yeah, that's pretty much a done deal, man. It really looks like Adler is the way to go.
All right, good for her. Good for her. Did she interview with us?
She got invited and should be there sometime in the next few weeks, I believe.
Oh, okay. Good. Maybe I'll interview her.
Maybe. Try to keep a straight face.
What's that?
Try to keep a straight face when you're interviewing her.
Yeah, I'm interviewing in 2 weeks from today, so if she's coming, maybe I'll catch her. I'll give her high passing scores.
Cool, man. Thanks. Well, we should talk about that a little bit more later, because she's trying to make up her mind between the two programs. But she's definitely moving to Chicago.
All right. Well, good for her. Good. Yeah, we'll definitely chat about it. Jacob, what's the deal here?
I really appreciate your guys' willingness to participate.
Jake, we're happy to do it, or at least I am. I don't know about Clemente. He seems a bit begrudging.
No, he already told me he was happy about it.
Okay, is that what he said?
For Tom, and any friend of Tom is a friend of mine, and if Tom wants me to do something, I'm definitely going to do it. It always works out well for me when Tom has all these plans.
Me too. All right. Well, as I kind of said in the emails, I kind of just want to pull out some points of the article, the chapter, that I think might make for good radio, and give you guys an opportunity to explain some things as well.
Jake, where's this airing nowadays?
It's going to air on Wednesday, this one.
Yeah, on the Loyola radio station?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Very nice. Well, Jake, I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
I have a quick question before we get started, and I have to get serious. I'm wondering how long some of these responses ideally have to be. I could be a talker, but I can kind of keep it to a more restricted if I need to.
However long you want. You know, sometimes what I do is I kind of cut it up. If they're real long responses, which I invite, I kind of stop them in the middle, and for the live airing, I kind of give some context. That Dr. Clemente Vega just explained this, and now he's going to be explaining this, and then I just put it back on if I'm explaining myself.
Yeah. No, I definitely understand that.
Yeah, I kind of just want you to respond however you feel fit. So with that, maybe we'll jump right into it.
Great.
Okay, so as I said, thank you guys so much for participating. What I kind of wanted to start with was if Clemente, you could give our listeners a little bit of background on how culture and environment might play a role in development.
Okay. Well, culture, by its definition, has a significant impact in development. It's the development of values and attitudes that we have towards ourselves, towards our family, our neighbors, the world, and towards the environment. The classical example that's always cited is when they talk about culture, they describe the traditional Western culture of the United States as being very individualistic, while the Eastern cultures of Asia tend to be more collectivistic, which means that they value the welfare of the group before, or they prioritize the welfare of the group before their own individual needs. Now, speaking from a neurodevelopmental perspective, talking about the environment and its impact, we need to consider things of the end of the end the things of the end to the of adequate nutrition or of the end to the, adequate nutrition and that things that begin the end in the womb prenatal development also from the exposure to the toxins the access to proper medical services those will impact the development of the brain early on. Of course, many of these environmental variables can also be understood from an economic perspective. In areas that they're very, very much in need of resources, you're going to see these negative impact of the environment. Now, from culture, the impact on development can be rather variable from one individual to another, and very independent from the environment. As a neuropsychologist, the environment. What I see between what the culture's differences, I summarize what it more the impact it has on the development of personality and also behavior. For example, a classical example that I use is the discipline method that the Hispanic culture, such as my own, use in their children from early on. It tends to be less structured. They don't really emphasize rule setting in the home. Tend to just kind of be and do whatever they want. While more often in the Western English culture, what you see is that children, they tend to have a very structured home environment. They have bedtime, they have meal times, they have play time, et cetera. Should I stop there? Because I feel like I'm talking way too much.
Thanks, Jake. It was horrible. I want to learn more about his history.
So what I also wanted to talk about was, so I mentioned behavior, but also in personality, some of the things that stick out or are more noticeable, again, picking on my fellow Hispanics, the personality tends to be a lot more extroverted. They're very dramatic and energetic. In psychology, we use the term histrionic to describe this type of personality. That's more common in the Caribbean countries. While Central American Hispanics, they actually tend to be, their personality is a lot more reserved. They're very quiet. They don't make eye contact when they're speaking to other people. So even within the Hispanics, you notice that their culture has a influence in how their personality develops. Certainly agree with that, Tom.
I think there's definitely inherent biological mechanisms that exist within each and every one of us. Certainly there's critical periods that have been laid out as far as brain development, branching in the brain. But I think over time we began to realize that even these processes from a very early age are dramatically influenced by the type of environmental input that we receive. So those infants that receive a lot of positive environmental stimuli tend to have much more growth and brain development opposed to those that are not receiving the proper environmental input. Even though that biological process is laid out environmental input, even though that biological environment plays a fundamental role, even though that biological environment plays a fundamental input, even though that biological environment plays a fundamental input, even though that biological environment plays a fundamental input, even though that biological environment plays a
mental input, even though that biological environment plays a mental input, even though that biological environment plays a mental input, even though that biological environment plays a mental input, even though that
is acknowledged as it should be either in the neuropsychological context or even the everyday context.
Yeah. If I can back it up just for 1 minute,
please.
Kind of define, I think, some of the ideas that we're discussing, some of the ideas that we're discussing,
first of all,
some of the ideas that we're discussing, some of the
which is
very much developed out of
over time culture plays a significant role in that. And just to define, again, going, Clemente was discussing culture and the context of his own Cuban upbringing and own kind of input from his learning experiences. But I think it's important before we begin to kind of discuss the difference between what culture, ethnicity, and race is. Race is a construct that's socially constructed. They essentially imply some biological basis of who we are, such as our skin color, the color of our hair, things of that nature. But what it doesn't say is anything about behavior. And race doesn't have any necessarily input on the behavior, the way we are, our intelligence, and things of that nature. Ethnicity is more of an acceptance of group norms and practices deriving out of our culture of origin, which is largely often based on our race. Whereas culture is kind of the embodiment of all these practices. It encompasses essentially, the way we live, informed by our historical, our economic, our political, our ecological systems. And it says a lot about our behavior. And so really culture is very embedded and dynamic with the way that we do behave. And behavior encompasses not only our actions that are overt or covert, but also our thoughts, our personality, and everything that goes along with that. The question was?
Well, it's kind of just expanding. Before we even get to that question, kind of expanding on what you were saying, you guys mentioned an article in the paper about that talks about those who talk about racially based intellectual superiority really miss the point, because this line of argument misses the underlying factors of culture which contribute to these observed differences.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, race is something that's socially constructed. It really has no inherent meaning to behavior, intelligence, or anything along those lines. But race does correlate or a covariate with various cultural norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our intelligence, our
language,
does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our
culture,
which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our
every level,
which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our
traditional Western,
which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our
many of the
which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our
activities that the
which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior, perhaps our norms, which does say a lot about our behavior.
Some patients once in a while come to the office, they have about a 10th grade level education, but rarely
do they present with a third grade level education, a first grade level education? And this is not uncommon of the Hispanics that we see in a clinic sometimes. So when there's a strong component of education that influences performance, you're going to have a bias in the instruments. So a lot of people at this point, at least within the field of psychology, understand the influence of education. One thing that I think it still needs to catch on a bit more is the approach to assessment and to some of our assessment and to
interestingly assessment very
and to
from
to
culture
assessment for example and to, in the US people they generally very
for example
in the US really they get a lot of reinforcement if they excel in anything a lot of reinforcement
it's work or school
in
or
sport a lot of reinforcement
really
to work
try your best and go
a lot
for
of reinforcement to work. So the approach in neuropsychological testing oftentimes reflects this mentality. Testing oftentimes reflects this mentality. Testing often in their gain and aren't purposely trying to appear as if they're impaired. The individuals that really are trying their best, they come in and they want to dominate this assessment just like they try to dominate their sports or their work. On the other hand, other cultures, they don't really have, they're not that strict about these attitudes. So their approach to the testing sometimes is not always optimal. They spend more time talking about things that in the test they'll get distracted and prefer to engage in conversation and rather than focus on the completion of the task.
And Clement, if I can jump in with that idea, particularly in, I think, a lot of clients that you may see that English is a second language that might be presenting in the clinic, I think there's also this expected norm that we've learned in this country through the educational system that you come in and you sit down at a test and you kind of know what's expected, you know, versus maybe other cultures or those from other countries where that might be not such a normalized thing in their lives, that they come in and very much as, well, we're going to sit in a room together. The importance becomes on perhaps developing a relationship, having a discussion, getting to know one another. It may be distracted from the test items as well. And then another thing you mentioned, too, was the idea of education and how significant that is in terms of the assessment, because often a lot of the norms are based off of educational attainment, which is often a good indicator for how much, I guess, positive environment someone's had over the course of their life. But a sixth grade education in Guatemala might not be the same as a sixth grade education in the United States, which might not be the same as a sixth grade education in New Trier versus a sixth grade education in the Chicago public system. And a lot of how we look at different injuries to the brain and things of that nature, one in particular would be like a traumatic brain injury. Some of our best kind of premorbid functioning are reading tests. One specifically is the National Adult Reading Test, the NART, which, you know, we give to clients who have maybe suffered some sort of traumatic brain injury, such as falling or a car accident. And generally, that skill of reading is a very complex skill, which might be more resistant.
Is a very complex skill, which might be more resistant.
Is a very complex skill, which might be more resistant.
And if we're just
is a very complex skill, which might be more resistant.
Educational level,
we're going to be at high educational level. Underestimating the premorbid intelligence of someone who didn't have the advantage of a nutrier educational system. That was kind of rambling. I don't know if you can add to that, Clemente, or say it more concisely.
No, not directly speaking about education. I think what could be said about what Tom was talking about is that
estimating a premotor level of functioning becomes a greater challenge when we do not have education as a variable to consider. With cultures from other countries where education is not possible because of economic hardship, we need to come up with a lot of different ways to get an idea of how this person was functioning before the traumatic brain injury, before the vascular accident, before the stroke that they could have had, because we need to understand how much they have lost because of that, the accident. And one thing that we talk about in our chapter is obtaining a thorough background history of the person's employment. Maybe there are individuals that never finished the fifth grade in their home country, but they always excelled at work. They were always the people that found the solutions to the problems or were the leaders inside of the community. And that gives us a much better idea what kind of individual this was prior to the injury than the fact that they never completed the fifth grade.
On another related point that you make in the chapter is how practitioners and even people in everyday life have some unconscious biases. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah. The shift in kind of looking at biases over time, and this isn't specific to the field of neuropsychology, but psychology in general, has really been this push to move past what we've traditionally considered very overt biases, overt racism, things of that nature, to something that's more considered a covert bias. Claude Steele from Stanford University has talked a lot about this, and he's labeled it something known as stereotype threat. And stereotype threat is this idea that when we walk into a situation where stereotypically we're supposed to not do as well. For example, that's often considered perhaps females going into a math test, stereotypically not as good as boys. When they're reminded of that stereotype by simply saying as girls tend to not do as well on this math test as boys, we actually find that girls do worse on the test if they were never reminded of that stereotype. Essentially, it's when we recognize the negative stereotype that's attributed to us that we essentially confirm it, kind of like a self-fulfilling hypothesis. And so this is really an essential component to any assessment, particularly if I'm working with perhaps an impoverished African-American child doing assessment, in Chicago. And the child comes in and I say something along the lines of, these are kind of, we'll be doing some academic type tasks today. And, these might be kind of hard. That itself could be a stereotype threat to that youngster. And they would actually fulfill and perhaps do worse on the test. And Steele has shown that this has actually been more salient in high stakes testing, rather testing that has something on the line like passing a grade, Social Security benefits, being moved in or out of a special education classroom. Clemente, you have anything to add in regards to stereotype threat?
No, as Tom is explaining, the stereotype threat could be coming from both sides. It could be the practitioner's own idea of how this individual is going to be performing on a particular or performing on a particular task or behave while they're in the office, or it could be the actual individual taking the task, their own idea of how they're supposed to perform just because of what their stereotype is.
And this is particularly important when we think about all the variations of culture, or all the aspects of culture that there are. considering gender, race, bilingualism, age even has been shown to contain a significant stereotype threat. There's a lot of research to suggest that, losing your memory as you grow older isn't something that's really that typical until you actually get to more significant aging, like 75, 80, 85. But because of that stereotype within our culture, that those who are 50, 55 do tend to believe that they don't remember as well, and in fact don't remember as well, just simply because of that stereotype, even though there's nothing inherently wrong with the brain at that point. This is, again, is very important, not only age, but when we're seeing someone of, when we're considering gender, low socioeconomic status, certainly there's some degree of awareness that those coming from more impoverished school districts, that they struggle more academically compared to maybe what they see in the mainstream media or what they see in their more affluent counterparts. And so when they're reminded of, perhaps the challenges they would have on a SAT test, on an IQ test, or any other kind of test that might be oriented towards high-stakes testing, they're not going to do as well, simply based on that stereotype threat.
And speaking of these other type of assessment instruments, the SATs and IQ tests, you also mentioned that these can be culturally biased in several ways. Culturally insensitive content or construction of test terms or formatting. Can you talk about this real quickly, and then we'll get into some final thoughts?
Yeah, and there's a lot of there's many ways that we could look at this because there are so many different aspects of culture. I can give you one example of where it's theorized culture plays a significant role in the IQ test. It's something called the Flynn effect, and that is from one generation to the next. Our IQs go up over time. So those taking an IQ test right now will be scoring about 4 to 5 points. I'm not sure if that's the exact number, Clemente, but 4 or 5 points less than those taking an IQ test 10 years from now. And I think what some would theorize that would be is that, well, we have more access to information. Culturally, education is much more stressed as time goes on, and so we see this rise in IQ. Some might say it's familiarity with the testing, but regardless, the culture that we live within over time has increased those scores to go up and up. There's certainly been a lot of politics around the issue of IQ tests. One of the more famous cases, Larry Pugh versus Riles in California in 1979, was a case which essentially banned high-stakes testing for special education in California, where they looked at African-American children who made up 17% of the student body, but 41% of the special education student body. Meaning that those kids were placed in classes which stress more behavioral issues, more remediation versus actual learning, which over time will compound their ability to be successful in the educational area. IQ tests, other ways, Clemente? I think one thing we could talk. Another way that the IQ testing has been culture biased is certainly there's a significant language bias in most IQ tests, and of course that would mean in cases where English is a second language, those kids or adults may be scoring lower on IQ tests and inherently be labeled as perhaps those with mental retardation, with borderline intelligence, or simply low intelligence. And this is something that occurs across states, certainly across the country, while we have some norms for Spanish-speaking, schools don't regularly use those norms and use those tests because of the available resources to test in Spanish. And certainly there's not available resources everywhere to test in other languages, such as, Polish or, certainly having specific dialects from South America as well. And that's something that that we do see in the school system quite a bit, where a four-year-old who might not have a good grasp on language, who's bilingual, whose languages might inherently be developing slower because of bilingualism, might get labeled as borderline intelligence. But when we look at IQ of a different sort that isn't so language-based, perhaps nonverbal or through creativity, that we find that sometimes these kids are actually performing above average, even superior, who are being labeled borderline intelligence.
So, Clemente, in maybe to wrap up on a final thought, in terms of differences among people that are related to culture and environment, what do you think it is that many people do not understand when talking about the everyday rhetoric?
Certain cultures, the way that we act, the way we behave, or just the nature of how extroverted or introverted we may be, I know this occurs specifically with Hispanics a lot, where they may just be having conversations.
Tom?
I think that over the course of our understanding of the interplay of biology and culture and all that, we have a long way to go. It's relatively a new, both fields are relatively new to us. Culture is something that's only been really stressed the last decade or so. Traditionally, the field of psychology, and particularly that of neuropsychology, has really been what you might consider the old boys club. It's really important for us as a field to begin to understand these things, to begin to open up to more cultures, those from different backgrounds, ethnicities, socioeconomic groups, those with different stories, and educational experiences to bring in. And until that happens, we're going to be, I think, stuck in some degree of looking at paradigms of culture and psychology in the way that we've traditionally done. And I guess the trick becomes Because of those cultural backgrounds of so many minorities, those from different countries, they're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not readily available to come into the field. They're not.